from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about sickle cell disease and why it largely affects African Americans. Then we'll hear from researchers who are trying to tackle the lack of diversity in clinical research.
We found that the people most likely to participate in clinical trials are white women over the age of 65. We also found that people of color are not as well represented in clinical trials.
Plus, a children's book author shares her new book, Dear Black Girl, I See You.
I always tell the kids that I serve validation is for parking tickets. I'm already validated. Once I validated myself, once I understand my worth, once I understand what I bring to the table, I don't need anybody else to tell me that I'm worthy.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. April is Minority Health Awareness Month. Our first two stories today look at the impact of the disproportionate burden of illness and premature death on racially diverse communities. About 1 in 13 African Americans are born with the genetic trait that can cause sickle cell disease. In Wisconsin, approximately 85% of these patients live in the southeastern region of the state. Dr. Prithu Sanj is a senior investigator at the Versity Blood Research Institute, working to find the root cause of the disease and how to prevent complications of the disorder that can often prove fatal for many patients. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about his lab's work. He begins by explaining the basics of sickle cell disease.
Sickle cell disease is a genetic blood disease, and it's basically caused by a genetic mutation in your hemoglobin, which is the protein responsible for carrying oxygen in your blood, and it's mostly packed in your red blood cells. So what happened thousands of years ago in areas, especially in the sub-Saharan Africa or the West African areas, people were exposed to malaria thousands of years ago when it used to be a wetland. And that's how this mutation developed, because it used to give protection from malaria. But then we all get one copy of a gene from our father and one from a mother. When two people with mutation, they had kids, unfortunately, those kids who got the defective copy from both the parents, this disease became symptomatic. So if you have only one copy, then you are a carrier. No, you're not symptomatic. But when you get two copies, you become symptomatic. And that's how the disease came. And it basically changes the shape of your red blood cells. So instead of being very soft, squishy, they become needle-shaped, stiff, and they stop in your blood vessels, and due to which your blood flow stops and you feel pain. And then it also causes organ damage. You know, it can cause respiratory failure. It can cause stroke, many other cardiovascular complications, you know. So that's the history and pathophysiology of the disease.
So we're talking about blood cells being impacted in the way they physically function and look. And obviously, blood is needed for all bodily functions. So I cannot imagine how complicated it must be to deal with sickle cell. And this is something that gets worse over time, correct? If someone has it, it is ultimately a leading cause of death.
After 3 months of age, the disease starts showing symptoms. And because of these blood events, your organs are damaged again and again and again and again. So as you grow older, your organs are being impacted so much that they start losing function. And by the time you're adult, a lot of your organs don't function as properly as it would function in a normal human being. Like your kidney may not filter or urine properly. Your liver may not function properly. Your lungs can have scarring because of the multiple events. You have pain all over the body all the time. You can develop blood ulcers, then the people develop retinopathy, their eyesight becomes, some people develop necrosis of the hip bone, joints become bad, bone marrow is all affected. Every organ in the body, you know, is affected. Children develop cognitive dysfunction because of silent infarcts in their brain, silent strokes, small events. So it basically impacts not only development, but also socioeconomic life, their adulthood, and also quality of life in general, I would say. Their quality of life is not as good as a human, normal human being, because of all these pains and sufferings, multiple visits to the emergency department, taking medicines. It just hits hard on their overall lifestyle. You know, it's just a debilitating disease. Median life used to be 45, but now I think it's 50s or 60s.
So with such an impact on overall quality of life and health, what populations does sickle cell affect the most?
So in U.S., it's mostly affecting the African-American, but sickle cell disease mutations have happened all over the globe along the belt where malaria was very prevalent. So the sub-Saharan Africa, then Middle East, some parts of Asia, and also because of the populations that didn't mix up with the whole world, they were more inbreeding, it survived there more. So now there are more than 8 million patients in the world. But in U.S., it mostly affects African-Americans.
So what does this look like here in Wisconsin?
So in Wisconsin, you know, it has a lot of veterans. So Milwaukee has 40% African-Americans. And you can say one out of every 300 African-American will have the symptomatic disease. And then one out of 10 are the carriers. So their kids can have the disease. So there are a lot of patients, at least 500 adult patients, and equal or maybe more than the pediatric patients in just Milwaukee. And then Milwaukee has also, you know, a lot of veterans. And although U.S. Army doesn't recruit sickle cell disease patients, but they do recruit sickle cell carriers. So there are many veterans whose family members have these diseases. So, and in Wisconsin, I think the Florida hospital is the only clinic which serves them. So it's relatively, if you compare sickle cell population all over the U.S., so Milwaukee has a very decent size compared to many places.
So with such a high population of people impacted by sickle cell, especially here in southeastern Wisconsin, what are some of the social barriers that are an obstacle to better care and treatments?
Yeah, you know, Milwaukee is, unfortunately, Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities, and most of the population patients who belong to a population that is not economically as strong, they don't have the best access. Sickle cell disease crisis can be triggered by many things, you know, your socioeconomic lifestyle, changes in temperatures, how you live, if you're having exposed to infection. So all these symptoms play into role, you know. And second, they belong to a community which has been underserved, so they have hesitation to approach healthcare, and many of them don't trust the healthcare system because of their experiences in the past. So that is also an issue. And then many times these patients are prescribed opioids for pain. But I've also heard and read literature that many times when these patients approach a pharmacy for opioids, they are denied. So that's also an issue. And then other social barriers are that they don't participate. They don't like to visit a hospital unless it's uncontrollable and they have to go, because they have anecdotes of mistrust passed on to them through several generations that they can be misused or their information can be misused. And so the history actually is there, but I think organizations, including organizations like Varsity, they're helping to get rid of that mistrust over time. And maybe next generation will be more willing to participate and approach healthcare system as needed.
So your job is researching these health complications that come with sickle cell disease. So can you share a bit about what your lab is working on and some of the big goals you're trying to reach in order to try and have treatments be more accessible or just to help understand this disease a little more?
So right now, there is no therapy that a patient goes to the emergency department and just takes the therapy and comes back. or something they can take at home to avoid going to the being admitted to an ICU or an emergency department. So we are basically trying to understand that how we can develop more like a rescue therapies that somebody gets into pain, unbearable pain. Is there something that they can take at home so that it can resolve on its own? Or they go to the emergency department and they quickly give that and then send them back home rather than keeping them in the hospital, because the healthcare, then you can cut down the healthcare cost. That's also an issue. Right now, it's around $4 billion for, and that's 80% of that cost is because of these people have to visit the emergency department for pain. So we can cut down that. So that is also we are considering. So that one of the main focus in the lab is to generate rescue therapies, therapies that can resolve a pain crisis or can resolve hospital stay, and they can go home quickly, or they don't even have to come with it. So we are working with some companies to generate subcutaneous therapies like an insulin injection, so that if a patient is feeling pain or nausea or has a signs of symptoms that they can go in crisis, they can take that subcutaneous injection. Because some of the therapies right now, you have to go to the hospital to get an infusion, IV infusion. We cannot do it at home. So that's the goal right now. We are trying to understand from the basic level that what is causing that and how we can resolve it if it starts to happen.
Dr. Prithu Sanj is a senior investigator at the Versity Blood Research Institute and professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last year. The Versity Blood Research Institute is a financial contributor to WUWM. In medical research, clinical trials are how new treatments, drugs, or surgeries get tested. They're how researchers figure out whether treatments work and whether they're safe and effective. But nationwide, clinical trials have a diversity problem. People of color are often underrepresented. It means that what researchers learn doesn't apply to as many people as it should. That can perpetuate poor health outcomes. Researchers from Advocate Aurora Research Institute, which serves Wisconsin and Illinois, checked on the health system's own clinical trials. As a part of the study, the researchers sat down with Black, Hispanic, and Asian community members to hear how they think diversity in these trials can be improved. Dr. Veronica Fitzpatrick is a research scientist who led the study, and Osandi Ozani-Lore is a senior research associate who helped with the community interviews. They join Lena Tran to share what they learned.
So the study was funded by the Advocate Charitable Foundation. So they gave us money to sort of look at the equity in our COVID clinical trials. And so through this, we were sort of like, well, if we're going to look at just our COVID clinical trials, which there were only like half a dozen, and Advocate Aurora runs like 80 to 120 clinical trials. So our COVID clinical trials were not a very large, you know, section of our portfolio. We sort of were like, okay, if we want to look at the equity in clinical trial in our COVID clinical trials, why don't we look at the equity in all of our clinical trials? And then why don't we look at how representative this is of our health system or our clinics or the area? And so we sort of took our funding and tried to answer bigger questions with it.
Just to back up, this is going to sound maybe really obvious, but why is it important that your clinical trials are representative of the community that you're serving?
Science and clinical trials in general is a fundamental kind of subject where if our trials are not equitable or if it doesn't show enough diversity, those results get perpetuated, and it creates, you know, kind of bias too. It creates a situation where a certain group of people are not, they don't get access to innovative healthcare, and it creates health outcomes disparity. If we have a study in that sense that's lacking diversity, it gets perpetuated. So somebody else would pick that study and, you know, make it a building block of their study. So solving that problem at its initial stage is very important.
It's not everyone is white men.
Exactly. Groundbreaking observation.
Yeah, exactly.
Not everyone is white men.
My research actually is mostly in care delivery and prenatal care. As we're seeing across this country, there's a really, really big issue with Black women in particular having, you know, maternal and their baby outcomes are just just embarrassingly poor in this country. And that's not anything that has to do with our healthcare system in general. That's just like across the board. It's so critical to have people enrolled in these studies who are going to be benefactors of the results.
Are there examples of medications or treatments that historically, like, their effectiveness was shaped by race or gender, and people realize, like, oh, it's because we just weren't assessing how well they work on all the right people?
I think heart disease is a really good example of that. I think that generally it was thought, I mean, because all clinical trials for heart disease were in white men, you know, and the way heart disease looks in women is very, very, very different than men. And the drugs and the treatments weren't as effective in women. And so finally they were like, wait a minute, maybe we should include women in clinical trials. And it turns out that it was totally different.
So you set out to do this inventory. What are the trends that you find?
So we found that the people most likely to participate in clinical trials are white women over the age of 65. We also found that people of color are not as well represented in clinical trials. And so we set out to create like this environment where we could talk to the people in the community that we serve and see what the barriers are, what's preventing them from participating in clinical trials, and what solutions that they think that we could apply and make them participate more in clinical trials.
So what kinds of things did you hear from them?
I think the most interesting thing was when we started to conduct the interviews, trust was one of the things that was just in the back of my mind, because we all have that little bias in our heads. But what we found it was trust was a byproduct of the need for more knowledge about clinical trials, more of a presence in the community. If the people that we are trying to approach about clinical trials don't understand clinical trials because they haven't been exposed enough, or they don't know us as well, it's difficult for them to participate and trust us enough to participate in clinical trials.
I think there's a lot of mistrust among communities of color when it comes to any sort of experimental medicine, right? Very, very well-founded sort of lack of trust. And I think to Asandi's point, you know, not all clinical trials look the same, right? Like, some are experimental devices and drugs, and some are just, you know, an app on your phone. And so I think there's a misunderstanding that, you know, everything is this sort of, you know, take this drug that we've never tested, or try this thing in your heart that we've never done before, when a lot of clinical trials are not that. You know, the lack of knowledge about the depth and breadth and what they entail and how they are considered legitimate treatments, I think, was one thing that sort of rose to the top. Was not so much that people wouldn't participate, and not so much that people wouldn't participate despite not trusting the healthcare system, was just that they didn't know much about them. They didn't know anything about them until they were sick. You know, they didn't know where to even find clinical trials. They didn't know how to get more information about clinical trials. You know, and that was one of the things where we were like, oh, okay, so what can we do as a healthcare system to better educate the community so they wouldn't pass up this opportunity to be part of a potentially innovative treatment?
Yeah. How did it feel as someone who's, as a health professional, as a researcher, to hear some of those things?
There is an understanding to it. You know, one participant actually said, you know, when there is a study or a clinical trial going on, they see us. They feel that presence in the community. We're there recruiting. We're there talking to them about the study. But then when that trial or that study is over, we're gone. Because then we retreat back to do our analysis and our writing. But what we've done is we've created a relationship and a connection, and then we just kind of stop. And so I can understand that. And it's really important to have a constant connection with the people that we are serving or presenting this clinical trials to. So it's not a case of, oh, we just need you for now and we don't need you anymore.
What do you think it would look like to shift that relationship?
You know, we got so many solutions from our community members and even our clinical trial staff. And one of the things that we got out of it was creating a presence, creating some kind of connection. First of all, just having to sit down with them and listening to them.
Mm-hmm. I've been a health disparities researcher for over a decade, so I'm certainly not surprised when vulnerable populations. That could look like anything. That could be people of color. That could be lower income people. That could be people who do not speak English as a primary language. I mean, anybody who's really at a disadvantage in our super highly literate healthcare system. Osandi, I think you said it super well, which is like as researchers, we take from our communities and sometimes forget to give it back. And what are the dissemination products of research? It's manuscripts, it's, peer-reviewed papers, it's, presentations at medical conferences. And that is not where the community is. Right. And those are not things that the community understands. And so I think it's really on us. And we're lucky because we work in a healthcare system, so we can actually show what the results are and we can't actually make changes in our healthcare system. But I think that's, people's interview time and people's opinions means a lot to them. And to just take them and not give it back to the community, I think doesn't close that loop. And we're really, really trying to close that loop.
Going back to the listening sessions, I'm wondering if either of you have a memorable moment. Was there a breakthrough or something that really surprised you?
I was kind of surprised by how many people were willing to participate in clinical trials. It's a lot of interactions with the healthcare system. It's you have to drive there, you have to sit there, you have to have some sort of treatment schedule. But I don't think there was a single person that we talked to who was like, no way.
Right.
I would never do that. Mm-hmm. Like most people were like, yeah, okay. And we talked to old people. We talked to young people. We talked to almost everybody identified as a person of color. That was one of our inclusion criteria. But I was really surprised by that. Because even myself, I'd be like, I don't know. It seems like a lot of work. I don't know. Yeah. But really, people were pretty enthusiastic. And again, even though people were like, I don't totally trust the healthcare system, they were still willing to participate. And I was just like, that's says a lot because I think there's this misconception that people of color don't want to interact with the healthcare system, and that is not true based on the people we interviewed.
Which is like a scientist's dream, right? There's this whole pool of data, but you've just got to bridge the gap.
Totally.
They're willing to share it.
I think we make as researchers, as predominantly white people, I think we make a lot of assumptions about how people feel. And it's not until we go into the community and ask these questions directly where we can really fight those assumptions. And I think a lot of people assume if you don't trust the healthcare system, then you're not going to participate in a clinical trial. And the community was loud and clear. They're like, we are happy to participate in a clinical trial. We literally don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
And that's that point with that implicit bias, you know, because we already think in our heads, they don't want to. And maybe that's why we don't have them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Dr. Veronica Fitzpatrick is a research scientist, and Osandi Ozani-Lohr is a senior research associate at Advocate Aurora Research Institute. They spoke with Lena Tran last year. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 20 minutes, we'll learn about the Milwaukee Public Museum's bird collection. But first, we'll speak with a Milwaukee author about her new book that encourages Black girls of all ages to find their strength, embrace their uniqueness, and dream big in a world that can make them feel small. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A Milwaukee children's book author hopes her stories make having difficult conversations a little bit easier. Ebony Haynes is the author of Dear Black Boy, It's Okay to Cry, a book about breaking stigmas and myths around mental health and wellness for boys and men. Haynes just released her newest book, Dear Black Girl, I See You. It encourages Black girls of all ages to dream big, to enjoy what makes them happy, telling them they're worthy and that they're enough. Haynes is the CEO of E-Inspires LLC, a consulting company that does education and workshops around mental health awareness, youth development, and DEI. She also works in an equity department for Milwaukee Public Schools. She joins WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell to talk about the book and her work. And a note to our listeners, this conversation does mention suicide.
At some point, my career took a change from journalism and communications to youth development. I was like in one of those dark places where I was like, I need to do something that brings me purpose. And so I started working with young people. Well, when I was 19, but as a career, when I was 24, I started working at the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Milwaukee. And just a lot of the things that I would see in the work that I was doing, of course, I'm just always like, how do we have a conversation about this? Because I didn't have an educational background. And in 2016, I lost my cousin to suicide. He was a 35-year-old Black man. And I recognized that there was this like story, there was this challenge in so many Black and brown communities, but even just in my own family, this stigma, right? Like that we weren't talking about. And I sat in a lot of rooms, a lot of trainings, and everything was just so educational, right? Like ACEs and, you know, understanding your frontal lobe, you know, like, but I'm like, if I'm a mom and my kid is battling with mental health challenges, how do I just have a regular conversation about that? And so that's really where the ideal of like taking these topics and presenting them in the form of a children's book came from. Really just being able to start a conversation, even something that may seem controversial, right? To say, dear Black boy, it's okay to cry. That's going to be a conversation starter. And then how do we then dive deeper into why? And so what other things are you taught not to do? And why are you not taught to do those things? And how is that harming you and your mental health and wellness? And so it really just became like, I could put this in a book. And it's a children's book, and the pictures are nice, and it tells a story, and it has a deeper meaning. And as an educator, right, it's not just a book, but it's a tool that can support with teaching and educating. And so that's kind of the journey. It was like things were happening, and I recognized that our stories needed to be told. Same with Dear Black Girl. I was not intending to write that one. I went through a really, really rough patch in my life, was sitting in some darkness, and was just like, how do I get myself out of this? And I just started writing and affirming myself. And eventually I was like, I work in a school district. I know all the disparities that our Black and brown girls are dealing with. I know how invisible they are in every system that they exist in. And so, Dear Black Girl, I See You was the message to that.
So you recently had a book event at the Milwaukee Public Library. You did a read-along, signed some books. There was a Q&A. But I pulled out something from the press release about that event that I want to read. So it says, this book is dedicated to Black girls, offering them affirming messages of visibility, love, and self-worth. Why is it vital that Black girls have that?
It's extremely important, you know, I think for anybody to see that, but I think especially communities that are marginalized, because so often the message that we get is the opposite, is that we're not of value, is that we're not as pretty, is that we're not right, you know. So we think about even just like our features and like how growing up sometimes having, you know, larger features or things like that could, at some point we were taught that it was ugly, but then the entire world tries to emulate it. And so it's like, well, you all, the world or the systems or the structures, right, will make us feel less than for everything, but it'll be the very thing that they try to take from. And so just thinking about how do we remind ourselves, how do we remind our children, you know, just of the power that we have and just being and being ourselves and then finding worth and value in that. I always tell the kids that I serve, validation is for parking tickets. I'm already validated. Once I validated myself, once I understand my worth, once I understand what I bring to the table, I don't need anybody else to tell me that I'm worthy. I don't need anybody else to tell me that I'm loved. But as a young person, you do have to be taught that. You come out the womb, you don't come out knowing these things about yourself. And so you adapt to the environment that has shaped you. And so if you are poured into, if you're affirmed, you grow up typically with more confidence, right? And you're able to learn, you're able to live, you're able to thrive. But we know that that's not the case for most of our children. And so just really being able to, you know, change the narrative, to use our voices. We see even on the national landscape right now, like anything that's not, you know, in this little box that they've created is wrong. And let's get rid of it. And let's cut it out and let's not talk about it, because there's power in that, right? Why would they be trying to silence our stories if our stories didn't have power? And so really reaffirming the power that we bring just in being who we are, being Black, being women, being, you know, all the things.
Staying on that blurb, like literally the next sentence says, the narrative is both a reflection and a celebration of the unique experiences that Black girls face, reminding them that they are seen, heard, and valued. I want you to talk about some of those experiences that Black girls have. You know, you mentioned working at NPS, like you're aware of the disparities, but I don't think folks really know like the unique experiences of little Black girls growing up.
Yeah, I mean, it's so many things. And I think that's where the, if you even like, if you see the book, the image on the front highlights a shadow, right? And that shadow is throughout the book. And she is a reflection of the invisible girl, right? That invisibility. And I think so often, so many of the things that our girls are dealing with, we don't talk about them enough. We don't, you know, they've become just normal things. They've become the way it is. I think one of the biggest things is the adultification of our Black girls. You know, they are viewed as much older than they really are. They are harassed at higher rates than any other demographic from a young age because of certain features. They're, you know, sexually abused at higher rates than other demographics because of that. Because of that same adultification, our girls are punished harsher than any other race in schools. And that's at a national level. I think the national rate right now is 1 in 6 Black girls is suspended, kicked out, or expelled. And that's more, 1 in 6, and that's above any other demographic, including Black boys. And so it's just all of these things, or sorry, they're 6 times more likely to be kicked out than any other demographic, right? And so because of that, it's that idea that my attitude, my, you know, neck roll, my talking back is seen higher than someone else because you've adultified me in this way that makes me older even when I'm not. And many times my acting out is a cry for help. And instead of realizing that I'm punished, I'm kicked out, and I'm sent through this system that never really just takes the time to see me for who I am and really honor my experiences. So I would say those are a lot of the experiences that we see. And then because of that, we see like the mental health challenges are much higher because of social media. Because I'm constantly seeing these images of beauty. I'm constantly seeing these images of, you know, the lavish life. And if I don't have that now, I don't feel good enough. I don't feel worthy. I don't feel seen. And so it's so many of them that I feel like I could talk about, unfortunately. But I also think, you know, we are resilient. I think we are, or I know that we are powerful. And I know that we have the ability to rise above those things if we use our voice and if we own and take back our power. And I think that's the piece that's missing and why our voices are always silenced.
When, you know, you're writing this book and also when the illustrator Jasmine is doing her thing with the drawings, right? What did you all want to ensure came across in that wording plus the imaging?
So I think twofold, the thought process, right, is I see you. And so as I thought about that, I really thought about, you know, what does it mean to be seen? And that's where this invisible girl came from, because I'm like, well, why do I need to be seen? Because I exist in so many spaces where people don't see me. Even if they see, right, me, they don't really see me, not all of me, at least. And so Jasmine, she is a genius. She is so amazing. She illustrated both of my books. And they would not be what they are without her images. And so really being able to tell the story, historically, there are so many images that represent spirituality, that represent our ancestors, that represent just being free, like just, you know, the playground and, you know, jump rope and chalk and like these experiences that when we are at that intersection of being always looked at as older, we don't always get to experience that. We don't always get to just be a little girl because somebody took that from us, right? And so just being able to really portray that through the images and using that invisible girl, there's an image in there. Well, I love all of them, but there's one that highlights social media, that highlights, you know, all of the things that are looking at us and the things that we're watching and just how that takes from us and what happens when we shift from that. And the invisible girl in the book is typically the one that's like doing the thing that like we should be doing, or, and I don't want to say should, but like centering herself in wellness, or she's the one that's like pouring the affirmation. She's the one that's like, you know, in the background and like, hey, I'm here. But nobody's really paying attention to that girl. And so that's a lot of what I wanted to portray, is just like these backgrounds that we see and we know so often. But like, what are we missing when we're looking at that?
You know, we're in this time right now where books that show diverse people, diverse perspectives have been painted as divisive. Banned, they're taken out of classrooms, things like that. I know you mentioned you're only a two-time author currently, but has that impacted your work at all?
It has not, but I do think that it's encouraged my work because I think, right, I like I mentioned earlier, I always tell the young people, anytime somebody is trying to erase your story, it's because your story has power. Mm-hmm. It's because the truth of your story will set people free. It's because the truth of your story will shine light on darkness. And when you live in a world that feeds off of darkness, they don't want the light. And so your job is to be the light. And so often books that are banned are books that are true. Books that tell the true story of, you know, my cultural experience versus, you know, someone else's experience. And so I kind of joked a little bit, and I don't know if this is the greatest thing to joke about, but I'm like, you know, it might be an honor to make it on that list one day, because that means that it's made it to enough schools and in enough, you know, classrooms where somebody was like, hold on, why is Just for Black Girls? You know, that's kind of like, why is Just for Black Girls? But I think Toni Morrison said it best, is like, I write books for Black people, and you don't got to read it. You don't like, that's what I write books for. But I also always paint the picture of my childhood, and that I grew up in the Disney era. And when I was growing up, there was never a princess that looked like me, ever. Did that stop me from enjoying the stories of the princesses? Nope. I still thought they were awesome. I still thought they were great. Belle was my favorite. But when Tiana came, it was like, oh, wait, it validated it more. It didn't mean that I didn't feel it when I didn't see it, but it did something different for me in that moment. And I was 20, was I 20 when Tiana came? I think I was like 20, but I still felt like that little girl, right, for that first time seeing a princess and going, but that one looks like me, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, even with dolls, I can play with all of them, but there is power in having the diversity and having the reflection of the world that we live in. And so I just, you know, I always use that as my example to highlight, if I can read someone else's story and still get something out of it, you should be able to read mine and still get the message out of it. And if you don't, then, you know, maybe the message wasn't for you. And that's okay too.
Any final thoughts of what you want people to take away from your book, Dear Black Girl, I See You?
Yeah, I think one of the final things that I would say for me is just reminding people too that like we all have an inner child that lives within us. And so, you know, the book is not just for girls. It's not just for like young girls. And also, if you've seen the images, they're actually of older girls. I'm very intentional about that for representation purposes, because I know that most children's books that are written with, you know, typically kids that are like between the ages of like 5 and 10, right? Like you get like the little kids. And that also to me is a part of the issue, is that there is this age where we cut off the innocence of Black children many times. And so how do I still paint that children's book through images of older youth and showing their innocence as well? Even if I am a teenager, I still have that innocence in me and I still deserve to experience that. And so I would just share that, right? It's not just for girls. It's for everybody. It's something for everyone that everybody can get something out of. And then just, you know, that my goal with the book is not just for it to be a book, but for it to be a tool to use it, to have the conversation. As I mentioned, I'm a consultant, so I do a lot of work with organizations and all kind of places, schools, organizations, churches, all the places of really just coming in and starting the conversations and leading workshops, and just reminding ourselves that we also need more of that, because the more they try to take it out of our schools and the more they try to take it out of, places where our kids are, then we have to then create those spaces for ourselves to make sure that they're still learning about who they are and where they come from.
Ebony Haynes is the author of the new book, Dear Black Girl, I See You. She spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll get a behind-the-scenes look at the Milwaukee Public Museum's Zoology Department and learn about their massive collection of birds. That's next on Lake Effect. On 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. At the Milwaukee Public Museum, millions of artifacts that aren't on display are stored in backroom drawers and cabinets. As part of our series Behind the Scenes at MPM, we explore the Zoology Department's vast bird collection. Julia Colby is the museum's zoology curator. She says many of the specimens are used for research and that some of the collection will be displayed for the first time at the Future Museum. I met with Colby alongside WUWM's Eddie Morales to learn about the history and future of MPM's bird collection. About how many items in the Milwaukee Public Museum's collection are in the zoology department?
It's about 2 million specimens. That's a rough estimate. Some of them are, drawers and drawers and drawers of insects, which we think we've counted accurately, but I think that there's some material there that is not, So it's about 2 million, though, total.
How much of that ends up actually on the floor?
Less than 1%. It's a tiny, tiny amount. And a lot of it, as we'll talk about here in a little bit, is just if we put them on display, like what would the public get out of them versus the harm to the object or the space that we'd take to display it? It's just not evocative. It doesn't help us tell the story that we want to tell, and so it doesn't really serve a purpose to be out.
It's interesting. So I'm looking at some of the collection, and this is from Delavan, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, Walworth, and then I'm also seeing these are all orioles, right?
Yes, these are, who are these guys? Black-headed Scots, hooded, and orchards. The orchards I think you find around here. The other ones I think are western or eastern,
yeah,
the orchards.
Arizona.
Yeah, so we do have, this is a synoptic collection. It covers most of the U.S. It's not every bird that occurs in the U.S., but we would have either purchased or traded or sent people out to collect material for us. And around the turn of the century, it was very common and not unusual at all to have a private collection like this. And so we would have purchased those as they became available as well.
So looking at this today, mm-hmm. you said, a lot of the collection looks different when it's a modern collection, but how is this kind of collection used in modern research?
So we get requests. Often people want data, so they might want where occurrence has been historical occurrence data. So has this species range changed because of human influences like habitat loss? Has the range changed because of climate change? You can map out historical points on a map and you can say, okay, this is where they were. Are they still there? You can look at migration data with these. So this is a lot of North American birds migrate from Central and South America every year, sometimes as far as like the Arctic Circle in Canada. And they will stop off along in Wisconsin to refuel and rest. And so that's when we tend to see them, and maybe we don't see them at all for the rest of the year, except for those two times when they're coming up in the spring and going down in the fall. But some of them don't make it. And so having those points tells you, okay, this is the earliest record that we have for you know, whatever kind of warbler it is. And here's the latest, and that tells you their migration range, and that can help you determine what that migration route looks like, when they come up, maybe who they co-migrate with. And if you have enough of these collections, so using just our collection gives you a little wedge of that data, but if you go to collections all over the country, it gives you the rest of that picture. And you can start to get further data from there. You can also do things with these collections like we do allow people to come in and do with, you know, they got to do some paperwork to do it, but, you know, you can get some DNA out of specimens like this. We're very cautious about that because it is destructive sampling. You can look at mites. We have an albatross that is unfortunately not accessible at the moment, but he's got mites. You know, he's got little lice all over him. Not all over him. They're not crawling. But, you know, he does have, there are a couple spots where you can see that there's a bird louse. And who knew that an albatross gets bird lice? And how are you going to go catch that albatross and study that bird lice, you know? So it's very useful for a lot of stuff. It's just those things are not quite as so obvious as what bird is this and, you know, how big do they get, that sort of stuff.
It's amazing how many, because I assume all of these lockers are just full of these drawers with different little guys.
Yes. So this is, as I said, this is our North American bird collection. So it starts over on the other side with ducks and geese. And then it goes all the way up into like the little, what we would consider songbirds. And the collection is arranged taxonomically. So everything that's closely related is closer together and everything that's more distantly related is further apart. So this is the beginning of like the blackbirds. It goes into owls. We get into raptors down at the end. And then on this side, we get into shorebirds and waders and stuff like that. So it's a big, extensive collection. It's heavily Wisconsin, but there is stuff from all over the country in it.
Is there any other benefit to having them in a more posed position versus the kind of, you know, laid out flat?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is how people relate to them. They're just so much more relatable when they look like an animal that you can look out your back window and see. And it's just much easier to interpret them. I think people empathize with them a little bit more. So if you're talking about conservation, it's much easier to say, you should conserve this bird you see all the time versus you should conserve this bird that you see all the time, but it's just lying there. You know, it's just they're active and they're dynamic. And, you know, good taxidermy really makes a huge difference when you're trying to tell those animal stories. And so that's sort of the benefit and why we would have those, you know, we might have a drawer of orioles down here, but we have five or six boxes of orioles up there because they're a common bird here and it's very easy to interpret them and go from there.
Can you talk a little bit about what you're expecting when it comes time to move to the Future Museum?
Yeah, so this is actually our first collection that we're getting ready to move, my first collection that we're getting ready to move. We're going to hire some folks to do inventory so we know exactly what we are packing when we pack it. So they're going to go through, they're going to check it off on the list, verify some data to make sure they've got the right specimen in front of them. It gets a barcode that will just be tied around the legs gently, and then we'll know how many orioles we have, what drawer they're in, what cabinet they're in. This material is easy-ish to move because you can move it in the drawer and then we'll just unload it. We'll either load it into new drawers and load those drawers into the cabinet, or we'll move it in these drawers and move them into the new cabinets. Some of the stuff, like the taxidermy, most of these are going on exhibit, but the taxidermy does get a little bit dodgier because you've got to, you know, you've got to keep it in the right orientation and you've got to keep it from tipping, and many of these are designed to be sort of clipped onto the wall. But it's, you just look at each one and sort of figure out how to do it and how to keep it supported and then go from there. I will say that it does keep me up at night, but it's not that bad. This is not the worst collection to move. This stuff is relatively hale and hardy and, you know, robust. There's some other collections where that's not the case, or they're just much more breakable, but this collection will be relatively easy.
You mentioned some of these items being on exhibit.
Yeah.
Will that be the first time that they've been on display?
I mean, other than being loaned out in classrooms, I don't think anything, these, you know, were never in cases at the old museum or even in this museum. So I think that these will be on display for the first time, essentially. In these collections were largely built for exhibit. That's what they were collecting for primarily, other than the scientific specimens. And so they definitely had an eye to the best things, but I don't know that any of these have ever been on exhibit. There would be certainly a lot of them if there were. It would just be a whole museum of birds.
What can people expect with how this department will have a space in the Future Museum?
I mean, so these birds, as an example, since we're talking about them, they're is, I don't know, I haven't seen the final like renderings of this yet, but we're talking about an exhibit called Migration South, which runs through one of the Wisconsin galleries, and up above is the migration of birds going south. Because most of these birds do not live here year-round. They live in the, they winter somewhere else, and they come up here in the summers to take advantage of the fact that we have longer day length in the summer. And so they will be flying or perched in trees somehow. We haven't worked all that out. But they will be migrating south out sort of towards our rainforest in the new building.
What is it like repositioning a taxidermied bird?
So you can do it. Most of these will be, if they're perched, they're going to be perched. They'll just be resting on the branch. It is doable, but it's a lot of work. And with older stuff, it's sometimes very, very fragile. Or, you know, maybe it's perched like that because you can't be, it couldn't be flying because there's like a tear or a rip or it's missing some feathers or something. So we won't be doing a ton of that repositioning. Everybody will get cleaned and sort of prettied up and fixed if they need a little bit of fixing. But, you know, we're not going to be like wholesale making them all fly, even though that'd be cool. But it'd be a lot of work.
Julia Colby is the zoology curator at the Milwaukee Public Museum. She spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales and me last year. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at the state of arts funding in Wisconsin. And we'll revisit a bubbler talk that explores what happens when an animal dies at the Milwaukee County Zoo. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.